Grizzly One.
Their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Seven minutes after the hour of five, yours truly, Curtis Sliwa, back at the helm, taking you home. And once again, our President Donald Trump has set it off. Apparently in a meeting yesterday with two representatives of the Gang of Six who were trying to put together a compromise solution of what to do with the Dreamer, a.k.a. DACA kids, and also reinforce security along the border. Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham came to the White House to discuss their success at bringing both sides together. They did not necessarily know that there would be other Republican congressmen there who are very anti any kind of compromise on the Dreamers or the DACA kids. And naturally, the president was hosting the meeting. And so it was a very long, extended conversation, as I would wish our president would have with all of our elected officials, because obviously it is the key issue of why he announced that he would run for the presidency from day one at Trump Tower in what seems so long ago. Immigration, first and foremost, that was the issue. Many believe that was the issue that propelled him into the presidency. But what exactly transpired? Because yesterday, at about this time, the Washington Post broke a story that said that the president, when dialoguing with the two U.S. senators and the Republican congressman, was referring to or asking why anybody would want people to come to our country from countries that were bovine aragonite holes. You see, I'm trying to clean up the language there because I've been told by management I cannot use the S word. Okay, I respect that. Bovine aragonite holes. And there was nothing that came from the White House at first. Those spokespersons assigned to the West Wing did not deny he said it. And then earlier this morning, the president responded on Twitter, denied that he said it, although acknowledged that he used harsh language. And then there was talk about how he referred to Haiti as opposed to the African nations. But one man who was there was Dick Durbin. He was the one Democrat in the room, U.S. Senator of Illinois. And he had a completely different take on things. He spoke first of how the president addressed the Haitians who are here.
When the question was raised about Haitians, for example, we have a group that have temporary protected status in the United States because they were the victims of crises and disasters and political upheaval. The largest group is El Salvador, and the second is Honduran, and the third is Haitian. And when I mentioned that fact to him, he said, Haitians, do we need more Haitians?
All right, he's talking about, do we need more Haitians? That's a debatable thing, but he did not refer to Haiti as a bovine organite hole. But then Dick Durbin said that was what he said about African nations.
He went on and we started to describe the immigration from Africa that was being protected in this bipartisan measure. That's when he used these vile and vulgar comments.
And then Dick Durbin, I couldn't believe it, said it was the most vile thing that he had ever heard attributed to a president talking in the White House or the West Wing.
I cannot believe that in the history of the White House, in that Oval Office, any president has ever spoken the words that I personally heard our president speak yesterday.
On the line once again, having to rise to the occasion with his sword and shield in his hand to defend the Trump presidency, is his honored defender constantly through thick and thin, Jeffrey Lord. who unceremoniously got dropped on his tuchus by Anderson Cooper and CNN, what seems like a lifetime ago. Thanks for joining us again, Jeff.
Thanks. It wasn't Anderson that dropped me. It was CNN.
Well, I want to blame Anderson, as you know. But, Jeffrey, when Durbin says it's the most vile thing he's ever heard attributed to a president while talking in the White House or the West Wing, I'm saying, didn't he ever listen to Richard Nixon's tapes when he was talking about Jews and blacks?
Exactly. You know, I mean, Trump aside here, the thing that gets me, I mean, this is a typical, this is the problem with the media, and I'm not talking left and right here. Mm. I'm just talking, it reminds me of junior high school. And, yeah, did you hear what somebody said? Did you hear? And then by you pass it through the chain and all this, and people get outraged and all of this kind of thing. Good Lord, you know, LBJ would sit on the, John, I'm cleaning things up here, and speak to cabinet members and staff members, summon them forth to stand there while he's doing his thing here. There's all kinds of stories like this from the White House. Nixon, Johnson, I mean, we know what Bill Clinton was doing there. I mean, the outrage is selective. I mean, right this minute, I'm looking at a tweet from Larry Elder, who's an African American and a talk show host out in California, and he notes that Hillary Clinton called Bill Clinton's campaign manager, and I'm going to clean this up, an effing Jew bastard, unquote.
Mm.
Well, so outrage. I mean, where is it? I mean, this is so selective.
All right. But you see, this is the problem. This is the problem, Jeffrey, because you know this president does not know how to stop. He suffers from what I call blabavosia verbosa. He makes those comments. Okay, whether you believe Dick Durbin or you believe some of the Republicans who say, no, he didn't say that. He used harsh language, but he didn't say that. But then he couples it by saying, yeah, why can't we get more people coming in here from Norway? And I'm saying, Mr. President, do you realize that's a socialized state? Those people don't want to leave that country. They got a maid in the shade. And more importantly,
well, I think, Curtis, I mean, let's be fair here. He was standing next to the prime minister of Norway the day before. So clearly Norway was on his mind. But, you know, let's just dispense with the idea. I was listening to Ben Shapiro this morning, and he's got his own website out there. And he points out that, yeah, there are countries in this world that are problems. That, as he says, Sudan in Africa is a dumpster fire. Anybody who wants to vacation in North Korea, you know, is going to wind up like that young man who got sent back and died.
I understand that.
This is ridiculous to pretend that these countries are not out there.
You're a vet. Ben Shapiro is a young little whippersnapper, not even wet behind the ears. He hasn't been a world traveler. You've been a world traveler. I have. Right now, our Pentagon, our intelligence agencies are saying the next hotspot for ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Boko Haram, all three groups united in their cause to destroy Western civilization, is the African continent. Now, right. If I am our enemies, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and their knockoffs, this is like in the locker room before the playoff games this weekend. I'm posting this up. You see what the president of the United States says you live in? You live in bovine organite holes.
I think that harsh truths like this, and let's recall, he said some version of this in his announcement speech when he talked not just about Mexico, but I was looking at this again today, not just about Mexico, but people coming in here from different places that shouldn't be here or we're not going to contribute to the country. And when you look at some place like Afghanistan, we got into problems with Afghanistan because it was a failed state, a failed country, which is why Osama bin Laden was able to go in there and set up shop and not be bothered. This is a problem in the world. So to acknowledge that is just ridiculous. And he never mentioned race. He said what he said.
I know, but Jeffrey,
when you mention
African countries, you're talking predominantly blacks, other than up north where there are Arabics.
Yeah, but
and Haiti is predominantly black.
But the condescension here that blacks can't form their own governments. I mean, you go right near us before you get very far from the United States, and there are all kinds of countries in the Caribbean that have black majority populations and are successful societies.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with being black.
Right.
Zero.
Right. But you see, that's what disturbed me, the juxtaposition, that why can't more squareheads from Norway, where they believe that Eric Red and Leif Erikson discovered the New World, why can't they flood into our country? They have the opportunity. They don't want to come here,
well,
Jeffrey.
I mean, what he's saying is you want to get people in here who are going to contribute to the country. That's his point. And when you get people, and again, he said a version of this in his announcement speech, when you get people who come in here and the idea is to sell drugs, which is what's happening along the border there, hence the whole situation with the wall, this is a problem.
No, understood. But, you know, the broaden the issue. We're talking about whether illegals or legals who come in who do the work that a lot of Americans will refuse to do. These Norwegians who come from a socialized state are not going to be picking crops, mucking out toilets, and changing the bedpans of our parents at home who are suffering the first levels of dementia and Alzheimer's. The Haitians will.
To boil it down very simply is, are we going to continue to let people in here in a lottery? Or are we going to bring people in who can contribue to the country?
All valid.
That's the essence of the argument. And whether they come from Norway, Japan, Thailand, Argentina, it doesn't matter.
All valid for discussion, and there should be caps, and I agree, and there shouldn't be an extended version where you get to bring in every man, woman, and child who are part of their extended family once they put dry feet on our territory. But the language, I mean, you would acknowledge that if, in fact, he did use that term, man, that does tremendous damage to us.
What we now know, of course, and I think this was part of his attraction, he's a New Yorker. He's from Queens. This is the way people in New York, and my family is populated with him. I didn't grow up there, but, it's very blunt-spoken street talk. He speaks that way. People knew this during the election, and they elected him. So you're not going to change him in that sense. He's going to be very blunt-spoken in the fashion of New Yorkers and Queens. That's just his style. You couldn't get Jimmy Carter to not be a Georgian or Bill Clinton to not be an Arkansan. I mean, it just doesn't happen. People aren't going to be able to change their spots in terms of how they talk and how they relate things based on what they learned as they grew up. I mean, to this day, I still have an accent from Massachusetts because I grew up there until I was about 15.
And that's why I hate you. I hate you because you're a Red Sox fan. You're rooting for the Brady Bunch this weekend. Admit that. Coach Belichick and the Brady Bunch in the playoffs against...
All I can tell you is my family is New York Yankees fans, and they take their pound of flesh. You'd be happy.
The Tennessee Titans. Anyway. Anyway, Jeffrey Lord. Do appreciate it. You definitely put up a spirited defense of the President of the United States. We'll see how this plays out over the course of the next few days because it will take on a life of its own.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
He's really a New York City hero.
Yes.
He's an American hero.
WABCRadio.com.
Time 28 for Sid Rosenberg. Vapangul, you. And I don't mean pasta bazool. Anyway, let's talk about, what can we call them? Heckle and Jekyll of the City Council of New York. You saw him yesterday getting slammed and jammed by members of federal law enforcement outside of the Immigration Naturalization Service building near Foley Square, downtown Manhattan. And members of the NYPD. Idonis, gee, have I yet learned how to speak English? Rodriguez. And Jumani, I'm at war with everybody. Jumani Williams, who's now running for the lieutenant governorship, right? You're qualified. So they're out with 300 people, don't have a problem. They're protesting because some guy named Ravi Ragbeer of Trinidad and Tobago, TNT, was being taken in by ICE. He was showing up for one of his mandatory monthly meetings, and they decided to detain him for deportation. Not because, you know, he was a law-abiding guy while he was here, no, and we've seen many cases like that in which I've taken the back of the illegals. You know, The father is here. He's been working a job. He's been paying his Social Security taxes with the fake, phony, fraudulent Fugazi Social Security number that so many have. And he's raising a family. Oftentimes, the wife is an American. The children are American. And ICE wants to separate the family and ship them back. But in this case, I almost have to agree with ICE completely based on what the president originally said deportation would consist of.
One of my first acts will be to get all of the drug lords, all of the bad ones. We have some bad, bad people in this country that have to go out. We're going to get them out. We're going to secure the border. And once the border is secured, at a later date, we'll make a determination as to the rest. But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
Now, interesting. So what kind of a bad hombre is Ravi Ragbar? Let me explain. Ravi Ragbar, educated, so we're not talking about somebody who could not read and write, came to the United States and was granted permanent residency from TNT Trinidad in 1994. So he was coming in legally. He didn't come in under the radar screen. But that permanent residency was revoked after he was convicted of wire fraud in 2000. And not because he was part of any political venture. It was greed, white-collar crime. He gets convicted. He served a 30-month sentence, but later asked the court to revise the original judgment. Why? Because he had ineffective assistance of counsel. This is the trick lawyers always do. They let another lawyer badmouth them so that their client gets another bite at the apple by insisting, the schlub, the Nebuchadnezzar guy who represented me was falling asleep in court. He really didn't represent me well. Well, guess what? The judge said, no dice. You had a fair trial. You got convicted. You did 30 months. You are educated. You knew better. You committed a white-collar crime even after you were given permanent residency. You got to go back. So he played out the string, kept going to his ICE appointments, but they kept warning him, you know, there's going to be a period. We got to cut the ties. You got to go back. And then all of a sudden, he was like Sarah Bernhardt yesterday. He realized this was it, and he fainted. Fake faint. So the ambulance comes, and then all of a sudden, outside, you have Idanis Rodriguez, and all of a sudden, Jumaane Williams, and they're like dolphins out of water. They're flipping all over the floor. You know, they're earning an Oscar nomination in terms of play acting with the cops. And then the brand new speaker, the puppet of the crook of all crooks, Joe Crowley, a Queens County Democratic leader and the congressman from Queens, his name, Corey Johnson, he's claiming the NYPD roughed him up. You know, NYPD, you should have given him an attitudinal readjustment. You should have given him a concrete facial and let him know what it's like when you're out there defending an enemy of the United States, a white-collar criminal who you don't want to be deported back to his country of origin, TNT Trinidad. All three of you are like the Three Stooges. You're a disgrazia. You're a shanda.
Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man of the people.
Between the Scylla and Charybdis of commentary.
The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
Fly, 5:38 as we continue here in the Drive Home at 5. Now, you know, of late, unfortunately, there have been a slew of a half a dozen young women in the pornography industry who have tragically lost their lives for a variety of reasons at a very young age, some by suicide, others by disease and other means, but they've come fast and furiously. So anytime you hear of or you read of a book or a magazine article done by a woman, and she talks about pornography, you immediately assume, oh, it was a porno starlet. That's not the case in this case. Erica Garza has written a book called Getting Off, One Woman's Journey Through Sex and Porn Addiction. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
So, Erica, just to be clear, you were never a participant in the pornography industry, correct?
That is correct.
So you were a consumer.
I was a consumer, yes.
Now, generally, we think of guys having an insatiable appetite nonstop for porn. How is it that you developed that appetite that started to eat up your life?
Well, I think it happened in the same way. My fascination came to me in the same way as it would for a boy. You know, if I was 12 years old. I was curious about sexuality. I started to explore my body. And then, you know, I came across some softcore porn late at night on Cinemax. That was my first experience with watching porn. And it was captivating, you know, and masturbating obviously felt good. And so I think that my discovery was quite normal. But not long after that, I started to use porn and use masturbation as outlet for escape and also to cope with emotional difficulties that came up for me around then.
Now, were you living with a stable home at that time, you know, mom, dad, other siblings?
Yes, I had an older brother, a younger sister. My parents were married. You know, I was raised in a Catholic home. I went to Catholic school from kindergarten through high school, and it was just a relatively happy, safe, normal childhood. Things started to turn around when I was 12. I was diagnosed with scoliosis and had to wear a back brace for 2 years. Mm. And that was really the beginning of me sort of feeling different from other people and emotionally distressed.
All right, but you know how siblings are, whether they're brothers or sisters, older or younger, and some parents, they get a hint that a child is moving in a certain direction. Did anyone try to do an intervention or question you or chastise you for this newfound interest you had in porno?
Oh, they didn't know that I had this newfound interest. So I kept all of that stuff really wrapped up and secret. I think they would have picked up on the fact that I was having some trouble coping with the back brace and all that. And they always tried to be as supportive as possible. But when it came to the porn and the sex, they had no idea.
Now, you know how guys are. If they're dating or they're in circulation and they're seeing a number of different lady friends of all different types, if they find a young lady who all of a sudden seems to have an interest in pornography like they do, they think that they've just hit Powerball, you know, Super Lotto, and that they can have their way with that young lady. Was that what it was like whenever you would come across guys that you had an interest in?
Yeah, they found it really exciting that I would want to watch porn with them. And I don't think that other women were presenting that to them. You know, they hadn't really experienced that before with other girlfriends. And so it was always very exciting. And I kind of fed off that, feeling really like I was the cool girl and he would like me more if I continued to want to watch it. And anyway, I wanted to watch it also. So it was kind of a win-win.
See, that's sort of different than the norm. You know, like this Sunday and Saturday, there's a playoff football action, the NFL, and there are a lot of women who are going to be watching it with their boyfriends or husbands or the males that they have an interest in. And you know that for many of them, they're placating them because they want to do and function and participate in what the guys like to do. But in this particular case of porno, were you having the same reactions physically that the guys were having when they were watching it? Because, you know, guys, they watch porno, they pop their top. All of a sudden, they're hot to trot.
Yeah, it works the same way for me as well, you know, and I think that that's the case for a lot of women. I'm sure there are some women who turn it on just to placate their men and to satisfy their men, but that wasn't always the case for me. Yes, I thought that they would like me more, but I also wanted to watch it as well. So I think that more women, if they're open and willing to be honest about their desires and their porn watching, then we would find a lot more similarities between men and women than we think there are.
Were you more interested in watching your porno, Erica Garza, with a guy or just by yourself, your lonesome self?
Definitely by myself. I often watched really hardcore clips and clips that I thought that if the men found out I was watching this type of porn, then they would think that, you know, there was something wrong with me. And I was really scared of being judged and being rejected for my desires and my interests.
Why do you think that is? Is that two guys can watch porn and be like having the time of their life, not thinking of one another being decadent or debaucherous. But if you were to join them, just as a voyeur, just in watching, not going any further, they would think that you were a freak and there was something wrong with you.
Yeah, I just think there's an extra layer of shame when it comes to women either talking about porn or talking about what they like in the bedroom. I think there's a lot that isn't being said because women are so often afraid of what other people will think of them, you know, and I think that it's perfectly understandable. There's lots of language around women and sexuality, like sluts and a lot of shaming, guilt-flinging language, whereas men can be seen as, you know, that's normal and men can be players and men can be studs and that sort of thing. And there's just so much shame and much more judgment on women than there are for men.
Now, did you ever hit the brick wall and you said, hey, I got to get control of this because it's starting to get too much control of my life?
Yeah, I'd known for a long time, especially throughout my 20s, that I had a problem. I just didn't really know what to do about it. And it's not very clear for sex addicts, and especially women who are sex addicts, where to go for help because people just aren't talking about it. So I'd known because so many of my relationships, I'd sabotaged, especially healthy ones, and I often put myself in these destructive situations and often unsafe situations, and I was just very lonely and disconnected and stuck, and I'd sabotage yet another relationship that I really valued, and it was simply because I didn't feel worthy of it, and I wanted to believe that I could change and live better.
You know, a lot of the guys who have acknowledged having sexual addiction problems, well-known people like Tiger Woods, Brett Favre, the former great quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, Wade Boggs, who is a great third baseman for the Red Sox and the Yankees, and others, other men of note, have said that they could trace their insatiable appetite for sex to the pornography that they were viewing on a regular basis. In this atmosphere now where women are coming forward fast and furiously, hashtag Me Too or hashtag Time's Up, you know guys would be looking for women such as yourself who had similar inclinations or proclivities towards porno, almost as if a justification. Well, you see, she was into it, and that's why I decided to take the first step, the second step, the third step.
I don't know about that. I think that's really problematic thinking. And I think that sex addiction can be used, you know, I think there's a real danger of using it to justify bad behavior. I don't know what to say to that, to be honest with you.
Well, would you say that, and if you don't mind me asking, how old are you now?
I'm 35.
Okay, so do you still consume pornography?
I do consume it from time to time, yes.
Okay, and how is it different now at 35 than, let's say, when it first dawned upon you at the age of 12 that this was a turn-on for you?
Well, now I have a healthy relationship with it because I was able to deal with the emotional problems that I was trying to escape from at the beginning. I don't use porn or sex in a way that helps me cope with distress anymore. I use it for pleasure. And, you know, my intention was never to stop being a sexual person or being open-minded or watching porn. It was really just trying to get rid of the shame aspect of it. I feel like that was the most destructive part of it.
Now, so much of what comes out of the porn industry is the woman is profiled as somebody being subservient, oftentimes to a man, sometimes to others, sometimes to groups. You think there's a danger there because it perpetuates that stereotype that women are helpless, that they're subservient, that they could easily be dominated?
I think sexuality is really complex, and, you know, the way that we desire is really complex. And I don't want to cast judgment on any kind of expression of sexuality that a person has, as long as they're not hurting another person. If a woman is into playing the submissive role in the bedroom, then, you know, and she's fine with that, she feels like that's a healthy expression of her sexuality, then that's fine. You know, it's not my place to cast judgment, and certainly wasn't my intention with the book.
All right, final question. The book is called Getting Off, One Woman's Journey Through Sex and Porn Addiction by Erica Garza, who is with us now. You say you started at the age of 12. Would you want other young ladies or even young men at that age to begin consuming soft pornography at that point, or should there sort of be a time and a place for that?
I think that there should be a time and a place in that. I would say instead of having, you know, granting permission for children to watch pornography, I would much rather be an advocate of parents talking to their children about what's out there in graphic images before they come across it. Because I think it's inevitable, you know, especially with the way technology is these days, they will eventually come across it. And if they have context and a safe conversation with their parents, then they'll be able to understand it better when it comes up.
Do appreciate that, Erica Garza. And as a parent with three boys, Anthony 14, Carter 9, Hunter 6, maybe the most difficult conversation a parent ever has with their kids is when they have to talk about the birds and bees. Well, let me tell you something. Wasn't anything I was looking forward to. And I know a lot of parents out there, they stumble and bumble when it comes their turn to have to deal with this.
Curtis Sliwa.
The next mayor of the city of New York.
Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
77 WABC.
Wow, it's been a Mob Talk extravaganza week every day, right? Every day it's been a Colombo, a Bonanno, a Lucchese, a Genovese, a Gambino, or a Di Cavalcante crime family member from across the Hudson River in New Jersey. And as you know, we were talking about Fat Joe Messina, who used to be the head of the Bonanno crime family from Old Howard Beach. He was wired up like a Christmas tree and took down his replacement. Hello, gorgeous Vinny Bassiano, the hairdresser wearing the light loafers there in the neck. But there was a replacement when Hello, gorgeous Vinny Bassiano was sent to Florence, the Supermax in Colorado. His name, Giuseppe Joey Camerano. And he was charged earlier today with conspiracy to commit murder, extortion, loan sharking, wire and mail fraud, and narcotics distribution. But there were a bunch of others that went down with him. And check out these handles and these nicknames. The Consigliere John Zanacucci, a.k.a. Porky. Joseph Sabella, a.k.a. Joey Valley. George Trapiano, a.k.a. Grumpy. Albert Armetta, a.k.a. Al Muscles. Joseph Santapioli, a.k.a. Joey Blue Eyes. All of those were Bonanno guys. Then there was Ernest Manciavecchi, a.k.a. Butch of the Genovese crime family. And finally, Eugene Castelli, a.k.a. Boopsy. The guy's handle, his nickname, was Boopsy of the Lucchese crime family. Now you know why the handles, the nicknames, the street names say it all.